was no great shock after the things I had seen and done in France, both in the war of 1944 and the hospital of 1744. Time makes very little difference to the basic realities of life. And smell aside, the walking shed was a warm, cosy place where the women of Lallybroch visited and joked between bolts of cloth, and sang together in the working, hands moving rhythmically across a table, or bare feet sinking deep into the steaming fabric, as we sat on the floor, thrusting against a partner, thrusting back. I was pulled back from my memories of wool walking by the noise of heavy boots in the hallway, and a gust of cool, rainy air as the door opened. Jamie, and Ian with him, talking in Gaelic, in the comfortable, unemphatic manner that meant they were discussing farm matters. "That field's going to need draining next year," Jamie was saying as he came past the door. Jenny, seeing them, had put down the mail and gone to fetch fresh linen towels from the chest in the hallway. "Dry yourselves before you come drip on the rug," she ordered, handing one to each of the men. "And take off your filthy boots, too. The post's come, Ian. There's a letter for ye from that man in Perth, the one ye wrote to about the seed potatoes."
"Why? I'll come read it, then. But is there aught to eat while I do it?" Ian asked, rubbing his wet head with the towel until the thick brown hair stood up in spikes. "I'm famished, and I can hear Jamie's belly garbling from here."
Jamie shook himself like a wet dog, making his sister emit a small screech as the cold drops flew about the hall. His shirt was pasted to his shoulders, and loose strands of rain-soaked hair hung in his eyes, the colour of rusted iron. I draped a towel around his neck. "Finish drying off, and I'll go fetch you something." I was in the kitchen when I heard him cry out. I had never heard such a sound from him before. Shock and horror were in it, and something else, a note of finality, like the cry of a man who finds himself seized in a tiger's jaws. I was down the hall and running for the drawing room without conscious thought, a tray of oatcakes still clutched in my hands. When I burst through the door, I saw him standing by the table where Jenny had laid the mail. His face was dead white, and he swayed slightly where he stood, like a tree cut through, waiting for someone to shout, "Timber," before falling. "What?" I said, scared to death by the look on his face. "Jamie, what? What is it?" With a visible effort, he picked up one of the letters on the table and handed it to me. I set down the oatcakes and took the sheet of paper, scanning it rapidly. It was from Jared. I recognised the thin, scrawly handwriting at once. "Dear nephew," I read to myself, "so pleased. Words cannot express my admiration. Your boldness and courage will be an inspiration. Cannot fail of success. My prayer shall be with you." I looked up from the paper, bewildered. "What on earth is he talking about? What have you done, Jamie?" The skin was stretched tight across the bones of his face, and he grinned, mirthless as a death's head, as he picked up another sheet of paper. This one, a cheaply printed handbill.
"It's not what I've done, Sassenach," he said.
The broadsheet was headed by the crest of the Royal House of Stuart. The message beneath was brief, couched in stately language. It stated that by the ordination of Almighty God, King James the VIII of Scotland and III of England and Ireland asserted herewith his just rights to claim the throne of three kingdoms, and herewith acknowledge the support of these divine rights by the chieftains of the Highland clans, the Jacobite lords, and various other such loyal subjects of His Majesty King James, as have subscribed their names upon this bill of association, in token thereof. My fingers grew icy as I read, and I was conscious of a feeling of terror so acute that it was a real effort to keep on breathing. My ears rang with pounding blood, and there were dark spots before my eyes. At the bottom of the sheet were signed the names of the Scottish chieftains who had declared their loyalty to the world and staked their lives and reputation on the success of Charles Stuart. Clanranald was there, and Glengarry, Stuart of Appin, Alexander MacDonald of Keppoch, Angus MacDonald of Scotus. And at the bottom of the list was written James Alexander Malcolm Mackenzie Fraser of Broch Turoch. "Jesus bloody fucking Christ," I whispered, wishing there were something stronger I could say as a form of relief. "The filthy bastard signed your name to it." Jamie, still pale and tight-faced, was beginning to recover.
"Aye, he has," he said briefly.
His hand snaked out for the unopened letter remaining on the table, a heavy vellum with a Stuart crest showing plainly in the wax seal. Jamie ripped the letter open impatiently, tearing the paper. He read it quickly, then dropped it on the table as though it burned his hands.
"An apology," he said hoarsely, "for lacking the time to send me the document in order that I might sign it myself. And his gratitude for my loyal support."
Jesus, Claire, what am I going to do?
It was a cry from the heart, and one to which I had no answer. I watched helplessly as he sank onto a hassock and sat staring, rigid, at the fire. Jenny, transfixed by all this drama, moved now to take up the letters and the broadsheet. She read them over carefully, her lips moving slightly as she did so, then set them gently down on the polished tabletop. She looked at them, frowning, then crossed to her brother and laid a hand on his shoulder.
"Jimmy," she said.
Her face was very pale.
"There's only the one thing you can do, my dearie. You must go and fight for Charles Stuart. You must help him win."
The truth of her words penetrated slowly through the layers of shock that wrapped me. The publication of this bond of association branded those who signed it as rebels and as traitors to the English crown. It didn't matter now how Charles had managed, or where he had gotten the funds to begin. He was well and truly launched on the seas of rebellion, and Jamie and I were launched with him willy-nilly. There was, as Jenny had said, no choice. My eye caught Charles's letter where it had fallen from Jamie's hand.
"Though there be many who tell me I am foolish to embark in this work without the support of Louis, or at least of his banks, I will entertain no notion at all of returning to that place from whence I come," it read. "Rejoice with me, my dear friend, for I am come home."
Chapter 35. Moonlight. As the preparations for leaving went forward, a current of excitement and speculation ran all through the estate. Weapons hoarded since the rising of 15 were excavated from thatch and hayrick and hearth, burnished and sharpened. Men met in passing and paused to talk in earnest groups, heads together under the hot August sun, and the women grew quiet watching them. Jenny shared with her brother the capacity to be opaque, to give no clue of what she was thinking. Transparent as a pane of glass myself, I rather envied this ability. So when she asked me one morning if I would fetch Jamie to her in the brewhouse, I had no notion of what she might want with him. Jamie stepped in behind me and stood just within the door of the brewhouse, waiting as his eyes adjusted to the dimness. He took a deep breath, inhaling the bitter, damp pungency with evident enjoyment.
"Ah," he said, sighing dreamily, "I could get drunk in here just by breathing."
"Well, hold your breath then for a moment, for I need you sober," his sister advised.
He obligingly inflated his lungs and puffed out his cheeks, waiting. Jenny poked him briskly in the stomach with the handle of her masher, making him double over in an explosion of breath.
"Clown," she said, without rancour, "I wanted to talk to you about Ian."
Jamie took an empty bucket from the shelf and, upturning it, sat down on it. A faint glow from the oiled paper window above him lit his hair with a deep copper gleam.
"What about Ian?" he asked.
Now it was Jenny's turn to take a deep breath. The wide bran tub before her gave off a damp warmth of fermentation, filled with the yeasty aroma of grain, hops, and alcohol.
"I want you to take Ian with you when you go."
Jamie's eyebrows flew up, but he didn't say anything immediately. Jenny's eyes were fixed on the motions of the masher, watching the smooth roil of the mixture. He looked at her thoughtfully, big hands hanging loose between his thighs.
"Tired of marriage, are you?" he asked conversationally. "Likely it would be easier just for me to take him out in the wood and shoot him for you."
There was a quick flash of blue eyes over the mash tub. "If I want anyone shot, Jamie Fraser, I'll do it myself. And Ian wouldn't be my first choice as target, either." He snorted briefly, and one corner of his mouth quirked up.
"Oh, aye. Why, then?"
Her shoulders moved in a seamless rhythm, one motion fading into the next.
"Because I'm asking you."
Jamie spread his right hand out on his knee, absently stroking the jagged scar that zigzagged its way down his middle finger.
"It's dangerous, Jenny," he said quietly.
"I know that."
He shook his head slowly, still gazing down at his hand. It had healed well, and he had good use of it, but the stiff fourth finger and the roughened patch of scar tissue on the back gave it an odd, crooked appearance.
"You think you know?"
"I know, Jamie."
His head came up then. He looked impatient, but was striving to stay reasonable.
"Aye. I know Ian will have told you stories about fighting in France and all. But you've no notion how it really is, Jenny.
Mokri,
it isn't a matter of a cattle raid. It's a war, and likely to be a damn bloody shambles of one, too. It's..."
The masher struck the side of the tub with a clack and fell back into the mash.
"Don't tell me what I dinna ken what it's like," Jenny blazed at him. "Stories, is it? Who do you think nursed Ian when he came home from France with half a leg and a fever that nearly killed him?"
She slapped her hand flat on the bench. The stretched nerves had snapped.
"Don't know. I don't know. I picked the maggots out of the raw flesh of his stump because his own mother couldn't bring herself to do it. I held the hot knife against his leg to seal the wound. I smelled his flesh searing like a roasted pig and listened to him scream while I did it. Do you dare to stand there and tell me I don't know how it is?"
Angry tears ran down her cheeks. She brushed at them, groping in her pocket for a handkerchief. Lips pressed tight together, Jamie rose, pulled a handkerchief from his sleeve, and handed it to her. He knew better than to touch or try to comfort her. He stood staring at her for a moment as she wiped furiously at her eyes and dripping nose.
"Aye, well, you know then," he said. "And yet you want me to take him?"
"I do."
She blew her nose and wiped it briskly, then tucked the handkerchief in her pocket.
"He kens well enough that he's crippled, Jamie. Kens it a bit too well. But he could manage with you. There's a horse for him. He wouldn't have to walk."
He made an impatient gesture with one hand.
"Could he manage is no the question, is it? A man can do what he thinks he must. Where do you think he must?"
Composed once more, she fished the tool out of the mash and shook it. Brown droplets spattered into the tub.
"He hasna asked you, has he, whether you'll need him or no?"
"No."
She stabbed the masher back into the tub and resumed her work.
"He thinks you will no want him because he's lame, and that he'd be no use to you."
She looked up then, troubled dark blue eyes, the twins of her brother's.
"You knew Ian before, Jamie. He's different now."
He nodded reluctantly, resuming his seat on the bucket.
"Aye, well, but you'd expect it, no? And he seems well enough."
He looked up at his sister and smiled.
"He's happy wi' you, Jenny, you and the bairns."
She nodded, black curls bobbing.
"Aye, he is," she said softly. "But that's because he's a whole man to me, and always will be."
She looked directly at her brother.
But if he thinks he's of no use to you, he will not be whole to himself. And that's why I'll have you take him.
Jamie laced his hands together, elbows braced on his knees, and rested his chin on his linked knuckles.
This will not be like France, he said quietly. Fighting there, you risk no more than your life in battle. Here.
He hesitated, then went on.
Jenny, this is treason. If it goes wrong, those that follow the Stuarts are like to end on a scaffold.
Her normally pale complexion went a shade whiter, but her motions didn't slow.
There's no choice for me, he went on,
eyes steady on her.
But will you risk us both? Will you have Ian look down from the gallows on the fire waiting for his entrails? You'll chance raising your bairns without their father to save his pride?
His face was nearly as pale as hers, glimmering in the darkness of the brewhouse. The strokes of the masher were slower now, without the fierce velocity of her earlier movements. But her voice held all the conviction of her slow, inexorable mashing.
I'll have a whole man, she said steadily, or none.
Jamie sat without moving for a long moment, watching his sister's dark head bent over her work.
All right, he said at last, quietly.
She didn't look up or vary her movements, but the white kerch seemed to incline slightly toward him. He sighed explosively, then rose and turned abruptly to me.
Come on out of here, Sassenach, he said. Christ, I must be drunk. What makes you think you can order me about?
The vein in Ian's temple throbbed fiercely. Jenny's hand squeezed mine tighter. Jamie's assertion that Ian would accompany him to join the Stuart army had been met first with incredulity, then with suspicion, and, as Jamie persisted, anger.
You're a fool, Ian declared flatly. I'm a cripple, and you ken it well enough. I ken you're a bonny fighter, and there's none I'd rather have by my side in a battle, Jamie said firmly.
His face gave no sign of doubts or hesitation. He had agreed to Jenny's request, and would carry it out, no matter what.
You've fought there often enough. Will you desert me now?
Ian waved an impatient hand, dismissing this flattery.
That's as may be. If my leg comes off or gives way, there's precious little fighting I'll do. I'll be lying on the ground like a worm, waiting for the first redcoat who comes by to spit me. And beyond that...
He scowled at his brother-in-law.
Who do you think will mind this place for you until you come back and I'm off to the wars with you? Jenny,
Jamie replied promptly.
I shall leave enough men behind that they can be seen to the work. She can manage the accounts well enough.
Ian's brows shot up, and he said something very rude in Gaelic.
Poeg mama home. You'll hae me leave her to run the place alone with three small bairns at her apron. And but half the men needed. Man, you've taken leave of your senses.
Flinging up both hands, Ian swung around to the sideboard where the whisky was kept. Jenny, seated next to me on the sofa with Catherine on her lap, made a small sound under her breath. Her hand sought mine under cover of our mingled skirts, and I squeezed her fingers.
What makes you think you can order me about?
Jamie eyed his brother-in-law's tense back for a moment, scowling. Suddenly, a muscle at the corner of his mouth twitched.
"Because I'm bigger than you are," he said belligerently, still scowling.
Ian rounded on him, incredulity stamped on his face. Indecision played in his eyes for less than a second. His shoulders squared up and his chin lifted.
"I'm older than you," he answered with an identical scowl. I'm stronger.
No, you're not.
I am. No, I am.
A vein of dead seriousness underlay the laughter in their voices. While this little confrontation might be passed off as all in fun, they were as intent on each other as they had ever been in youth or childhood, and the echoes of challenge rang in Jamie's voice as he ripped loose his cuff and jerked back the sleeve of his shirt.
"Prove it," he said.
He cleared the chess table with a careless sweep of the hand, sat down, and braced his elbow on the inlaid surface, fingers flexed for an offensive. Deep blue eyes glared up into Ian's dark brown ones, hot with the same anger. Ian took half a second to appraise the situation, then jerked his head in a brief nod of acceptance, making his heavy sheaf of dark hair flop into his eyes. With calm deliberation, he brushed it back, unfastened his cuff, and rolled his sleeve to the shoulder, turn by turn, never taking his eyes from his brother-in-law. From where I stood, I could see Ian's face, a little flushed under his tan, long, narrow chin set in determination. I couldn't see Jamie's face, but the determination was eloquently expressed by the line of back and shoulders. The two men set their elbows carefully, manoeuvring to find a good spot, rubbing back and forth with the point of the elbow to be sure the surface was not slippery. With due ritual, Jamie spread his fingers, palm toward Ian. Ian carefully placed his own palm against it. The fingers matched, touching for a moment in a mirror image, then shifted, one to the right and one to the left, linked and clasping.
"Ready?" Jamie asked.
"Ready."
Ian's voice was calm, but his eyes gleamed under the feathery brows. The muscles tensed at once, all along the length of the two arms, springing into sharp definition as they shifted in their seats, seeking leverage. Jenny caught my eye and rolled her eyes heavenward. Whatever she had been expecting of Jamie, it wasn't this. Both men were focused on the straining knot of fingers to the exclusion of everything else. Both faces were deep red with exertion, sweat damping the hair on their temples, eyes bulging slightly with effort. Suddenly, I saw Jamie's gaze break from its concentration on the clenched fists as he saw Ian's lips clamp tighter. Ian felt the shift, looked up, met Jamie's eyes, and the two men burst into laughter. The hands clung for a moment longer, locked in spasm, then fell apart.
"A draw, then," said Jamie,
pushing back a strand of sweat-damp hair. He shook his head good-naturedly at Ian.
"All right, man. If I could order you, I wouldn't do it. But I can ask, no? Will you come with me?"
Ian dabbed at the side of his neck, where a runnel of sweat dampened his collar. His gaze roamed about the room, resting for a moment on Jenny. Her face was no paler than usual, but I could see the hasty pulse beating just below the angle of her jaw. Ian stared at her intently as he rolled his sleeve down again, in careful turns. I could see a deep pink flush begin to rise from the neck of her gown. Ian rubbed his jaw as though thinking, then turned toward Jamie and shook his head.
"No, my Joe," he said softly. "You need me here, and here I shall stay."
His eyes rested on Jenny, with Catherine held against her shoulder, and on small Maggie clutching her mother's skirt with grubby hands. "And on me." Ian's long mouth curled in a slight smile.
"I shall stay here," he repeated, "guarding your weak side, man."
"Jamie?"
"Aye."
The answer came at once. I knew he hadn't been asleep, though he lay still as a figure carved on a tomb. It was moon bright in the room, and I could see his face when I rose on my elbow. He was staring upward, as though he could see beyond the heavy beams to the open night and the stars beyond.
"You aren't going to try to leave me behind, are you?"
I wouldn't have thought of asking were it not for the scene with Ian earlier in the evening.
For once it was settled that Ian would stay, Jamie had sat down with him to issue orders, choosing who would march with the laird to the aid of the prince, who would stay behind to tend to animals and pasture and the maintenance of Lallybroch. I knew it had been a wrenching process of decision, though he gave no sign of it, calmly discussing with Ian whether Ross the Smith could be spared to go, and deciding that he could, though the ploughshares needed for the spring must all be in good repair before leaving, whether Joseph Fraser Kirby might go, and deciding that he should not, as he was the main support not only of his own family, but that of his widowed sister. Brendan was the oldest boy of both families, and at 9, ill-prepared to replace his father should Joseph not come home. It was a matter for the most delicate planning. How many men should go to have some impact on the course of the war? For Jenny was right. Jamie had no choice now. No choice but to help Charles Stuart win. And to that end, as many men and arms as could possibly be summoned should be thrown into the cause. But on the other side was me, and my deadly knowledge, and lack of it. We had succeeded in preventing Charles Stuart from getting money to finance his rebellion. And still the bonny prince, reckless, feckless, and determined to claim his legacy, had landed to rally the clans at Glenfinnan. From a further letter from Jared, we had learned that Charles had crossed the channel with 2 small frigates, provided by one Antoine Walsh, a sometime slaver with an eye for opportunity. Apparently he saw Charles's venture as less risky than a slaving expedition, a gamble in which he might or might not be justified. One frigate had been waylaid by the English. The other had landed Charles safe on the Isle of Eriskay. Charles had landed with only 7 companions, including the owner of a small bank named Aeneas MacDonald. Unable to finance an entire expedition, MacDonald had provided the funds for a small stock of broadswords, which constituted Charles' entire armament. Jared sounded simultaneously admiring and horrified by the recklessness of the venture, but, loyal Jacobite that he was, did his best to swallow his misgivings. And so far, Charles has succeeded. From the Highland Grapevine, we learned that he had landed at Eriskay, crossed to Glenfinnan, and there waited, accompanied only by several large casks of brandy wine, to see whether the clans would answer the call to his standard. And after what must have been several nerve-wracking hours, 300 men of Clan Cameron had come down from the defiles of the steep green hills, led not by their chieftain, who was away from his home, but by his sister, Jenny Cameron. The Camerons had been the first, but they had been joined by others, as the Bill of Association showed. If Charles should now proceed to disaster, despite all efforts, then how many men of Lallybroch could be spared, left at home, to save something from the wreck? Ian himself would be safe, that much was sure, and some balm to Jamie's spirit. But the others, the 60 families who lived on Lallybroch, choosing who would go and who would stay must seem in some lights like choosing men for sacrifice. I had seen commanders before, the men whom war forced to make such choices, and I knew what it cost them. Jamie had done it. He had no choice. But on 2 matters he had held firm. No women would accompany his troop, and no lads under 18 years of age would go. Ian had looked mildly surprised at this. While most women with young children would normally stay behind, it was far from unusual for Highland wives to follow their men to battle, cooking and caring for them, and sharing the army's rations. And the lads, who considered themselves men at 14, would be grossly humiliated at being omitted from the tally. But Jamie had given his orders in a tone that brooked no argument, and Ian, after a moment's hesitation, had merely nodded and written them down. I hadn't wanted to ask him, in the presence of Ian and Jenny, whether his ban on women folk was intended to include me, because, whether it was or not, I was going with him. And that, I thought, was bloody all about it.
"Leave you behind," he said now,
and I saw his mouth curl into a sideways grin.
"Do you think I'd stand a chance of it?"
"No," I said, snuggling next to him in sudden relief. "You wouldn't." but I thought you might think about it.
He gave a small snort and drew me down, head on his shoulder.
Oh, aye. And if I thought I could leave you, I'd chain you to the banister. Not much else would stop you.
I could feel his head shake above me in negation.
No, I must take you wi' me, Sassenach, whether I will or no. There are things you'll maybe know along the way. Even if they dinna seem like anything now, they may later. And you're a rare, fine healer, Sassenach. I canna deny the men your skill, an it be needed.
His hand patted my shoulder, and he sighed.
I would give anything, Modunia, could I leave you here safe, but I cannot. So you will go with me, you and Fergus.
Fergus? I was surprised by this, but I thought you wouldn't take any of the younger lads.
He sighed again, and I put my hand flat on the centre of his chest, where his heart beat beneath the small hollow, slow and steady.
Well, Fergus is a bit different. The other lads, I will not take them because they belong here. If it all goes to smash, they'll be left to keep their families from starving, to work the fields and tend beasts. They'll likely need to grow up fast if it happens, but at least they'll be here to do it.
But Fergus, this isna his place, Sassenach.
Nor is France, or I would send him back. But he has no place there, either.
His place is with you, I said softly, understanding. Like mine. He was silent for a long time, then his hand squeezed me gently.
Aye, that's so, he said quietly. Sleep now, Modunia. It's late.
The fretful wail pulled me toward the surface of wakefulness for the third time. Baby Catherine was teething and didn't care who knew it. From their room down the hall, I heard Ian's sleepy mumble and Jenny's higher voice resigned as she got out of bed and went to soothe the infant. Then I heard the soft, heavy footfalls in the corridor and realized that Jamie, still wakeful, was walking barefoot through the house.
Jenny.
His voice, low-pitched to avoid disturbance, was still plainly audible in the creaking silence of the manor house.
I heard the wee lassie greeting, he said. If she canna sleep, neither can I, but you can. If she's fed and dry, perhaps we can bear each other company for a bit, while you go back to your bed.
Jenny smothered a yawn, and I could hear the smile in her voice. Jamie, dear, you're a mother's blessing. Aye, she's full as a drum, and a dry clout on her this minute. Take her, and I wish she joy of each other. A door closed, and I heard the heavy footfall again, heading back toward our room, and the low murmur of Jamie's voice as he muttered soothingly to the baby. I snuggled deeper into the comfort of the goose-down bed, and turned toward sleep again, hearing with half an ear the baby's whining, interspersed with hiccuping sobs, and Jamie's deep, tuneless humming, the sound as comforting as the thought of beehives in the sun.
Hey, wee kitty, kimau, mook, mo noinachan mook.
The sound of them went up and down the passage, and I dropped further toward sleep, but kept half wakeful on purpose to hear them. One day, perhaps, he would hold his own child so, small round head cradled in the big hands, small solid body cupped and held firm against his shoulder. And thus he would sing to his own daughter, a tuneless song, a warm, soft chant in the dark. A constant small ache in my heart was submerged in a flood of tenderness. I had conceived once. I could do so again. Faith had given me the gift of that knowledge, Jamie the courage and means to use it. My hands rested lightly on my breasts, cupping the deep swell of them, knowing beyond doubt that one day they would nourish the child of my heart. I drifted into sleep with the sound of Jamie's singing in my ears.
Some time later, I drifted near the surface again and opened my eyes to the light-filled room. The moon had risen, full and beaming, and all the objects in the room were plainly visible, in that flat, two-dimensional way of things seen without shadow. The baby had quieted, but I could hear Jamie's voice in the hall, still speaking, but much more quietly, hardly more than a murmur. And the tone of it had changed. It wasn't the rhythmic half-nonsense way one talks to babies, but the broken, halting speech of a man seeking the way through the wilderness of his own heart. Curious, I slipped out of bed and crept quietly to the door. I could see them there at the end of the hall. Jamie sat leaning back against the side of the window seat, wearing only his shirt. His bare legs were raised, forming a back against which small Catherine Mary rested as she sat facing him in his lap, her own chubby legs kicking restlessly over his stomach. The baby's face was blank and light as the moon's, her eyes dark pools absorbing his words. He traced the curve of her cheek with one finger, again and again, whispering with heartbreaking gentleness. He spoke in Gaelic, and so low that I couldn't have told what he said, had I even known the words. But the whispering voice was thick, and the moonlight from the casement behind him showed the tracks of the tears that slid unregarded down his own cheeks. It wasn't a scene that bore intrusion. I came back to the still warm bed, holding in my mind the picture of the Laird of Lallybroch, half-naked in the moonlight, pouring out his heart to an unknown future, holding in his lap the promise of his blood. When I woke in the morning, there was a warm, unfamiliar scent next to me, and something tangled in my hair. I opened my eyes to find Catherine Mary's rosebud lips smacking dreamily an inch from my nose, her fat fingers clutched in the hair above my left ear. I cautiously disengaged myself, and she stirred, but flopped over onto her stomach, drew her knees up, and went back to sleep. Jamie was lying on the other side of the child, face half buried in his pillow. He opened one eye, clear blue as the morning sky. "Good morning, Sassenach," he said, speaking quietly so as not to disturb the small sleeper. He smiled at me as I sat up in bed. "You look very sweet, the two of you, asleep, face to face like that." I ran a hand through my tangled hair and smiled myself at Kitty's upturned bottom, jutting absurdly into the air. "That doesn't look at all comfortable," I observed. "But she's still asleep, so it can't be that bad. How late were you up with her last night? I didn't hear you come to bed." He yawned and ran a hand through his hair, smoothing it away from his face. There were shadows under his eyes, but he seemed peacefully content. "Oh, sometime. Before moonset, at least. I didn't want to wake Jenny by taking the wain back to her, so I laid her in the bed between us, and she didn't twitch once the rest of the night." The baby was kneading the mattress with elbows and knees, rootling in the bedclothes with a low grunting noise. It must be close to time for her morning feed. This supposition was borne out in the next moment when she raised her head, eyes still tight shut, and let out a healthy howl. I reached hastily for her and picked her up. "There, there, there," I soothed, patting the straining little back. I swung my legs out of bed, then reached back and patted Jamie on the head. The rough, bright hair was warm under my hand. "I'll take her to Jenny," I said. "It's early yet. You sleep some more." "I may do that, Sassenach," Jamie said, flinching at the noise. "I'll see you at breakfast, shall I?" He rolled onto his back, crossed his hands on his chest in his favourite sleeping posture, and was breathing deeply again by the time Catherine Mary and I had reached the door. The baby squirmed vigorously, rooting for a nipple and squawking in frustration when none was immediately forthcoming. Hurrying along the hall, I met Jenny, hurrying out of her bedroom in response to her offspring's cries, pulling on a green dressing gown as she came. I held out the baby, waving little fists in urgent demand. "There,"
Mo mjörnin.
Hush now, hush, Jenny soothed. With a cock of the eyebrow in invitation, she took the child from me and turned back into her room. I followed her in and sat on the rumpled bed as she sat down on a nursing stool by the hearth and hastily bared one breast. The yowling little mouth clamped at once onto a nipple, and we all relaxed in relief as sudden silence descended. Ah, Jenny sighed. Her shoulders slumped a fraction as the flow of milk started.
That's better, my wee piggy, no?
She opened her eyes and smiled at me, eyes clear and blue as her brother's. 'Twas kind of you to keep the lassie all night. I slept like the dead. I shrugged, smiling at the picture of mother and child relaxed together in total content. The curve of the baby's head exactly echoed the high round curve of Jenny's breast, and small slurping noises came from the little bundle as her body sagged against her mother's, fitting easily into the curve of Jenny's lap.
It was Jamie, not me, I said. He and his niece seem to have got on well together.
The picture of them came back to me. Jamie talking in earnest, low tones to the child, tears slipping down his face. Jenny nodded, watching my face.
I thought perhaps they'd comfort each other a bit. He doesn't sleep well these days.
Her voice held a question.
No,
I answered softly. He has a lot on his mind.
Well, he might, she said, glancing at the bed behind me. Ian was gone already, risen at dawn to see to the stock in the barn. The horses that could be spared from farming, and some that couldn't, needed shoeing, needed harness in preparation for their journey to rebellion.
You can talk to a baby again, she said suddenly, breaking into my thought.
Really talk, I mean. You can tell them anything, no matter how foolish it would sound, did ye say it to a soul could understand you.
Oh,
you heard him then? I asked.
She nodded, eyes on the curve of Catherine's cheek, where the tiny dark lashes lay against the fair skin, eyes closed in ecstasy.
Aye. You shouldn't have worried yourself, she added, smiling gently at me. It isn't that he feels he canna talk to you. He knows he can. But it's different to talk to a babe that way.
It's a person.
You ken that you're not alone. But they dinna ken your words, and you don't worry a bit what they'll think of you, or what they may feel they must do. You can pour out your heart to them without choosing your words or keeping anything back at all. And that's a comfort to the soul.
She spoke matter-of-factly, as though this were something that everyone knew. I wondered whether she spoke that way often to her child. The generous, wide mouth, so like her brother's, lifted slightly at one side.
"It's the way you talk to them before they're born," she said softly. "You'll know."
I placed my hands gently over my belly, one atop the other, remembering. "Yes, I know." She pressed a thumb against the baby's cheek, breaking the suction, and with a deft movement shifted the small body to bring the full breast within reach.
"I've thought that perhaps that's why women are so often sad once the child's born," she said meditatively, as though thinking aloud. "You think of them while you talk, and you have a knowledge of them as they are inside you, the way you think they are. And then they're born, and they're different, not the way you thought of them inside at all. And you love them, of course, and get to know them the way they are. But still, there's the thought of the child you once talked to in your heart. And that child is gone. So I think it's the grieving for the child unborn that you feel, even as you hold the born one in your arms."
She dipped her head and kissed her daughter's downy skull.
"Yes," I said. "Before, it's all possibility. It might be a son or a daughter, a plain child, a bonny one. And then it's born, and all the things it might have been are gone, because now it is."
She rocked gently back and forth,
and the small clutching hand that seized the folds of green silk over her breast began to loose its grip.
And a daughter is born, and the son that she might have been is dead, she said quietly. And the bonny lad at your breast has killed the wee lassie he thought you carried. And ye weep for what you didn't know. That's gone for good. Until you know the child you have. And then at last, it's as though they could never have been other than they are. And ye feel naught but joy in them. But till then, you weep easy.
And men, I said, thinking of Jamie whispering secrets to the unhearing ears of the child.
Aye. They hold their bairns, and they feel all the things that might be, and the things that will never be. But it isna so easy for a man to weep for the things he doesna ken.
Part 6. The Flames of Rebellion. Chapter 36. Preston Pans, Scotland, September 1745. 4 days' march found us on the crest of a hill near Calder. A sizeable moor stretched out at the foot of the hill, but we set up camp within the shelter of the trees above. There were two small streams cutting through the moss-covered rock of the hillside, and the crisp weather of early fall made it seem much more like picnicking than a march to war. But it was the 17th of September, and if my sketchy knowledge of Jacobite history was correct, war it would be, in a matter of days.
"Tell it to me again, Sassenach," Jamie had said for the dozenth time as we made our way along the winding trails and dirt roads.
I rode Donas, while Jamie walked alongside, but now slid down to walk beside him to make conversation easier. While Donas and I had reached an understanding of sorts, he was the kind of horse that demanded your full concentration to ride. He was all too fond of scraping an unwary rider off by walking under low branches, for example.
"I told you before, I don't know that much," I said.
"There was very little written about it in the history books, and I didn't pay a great deal of attention at the time.
All I can tell you is that the battle was fought, will be fought, near the town of Preston. And so it's called the Battle of Preston Pans, though the Scots call it, the Battle of Gladsmuir, because of an old prophecy that the returning king will be victorious at Gladsmuir. Heaven knows where the real Gladsmuir is, if there is one."
"Aye. And?"
I furrowed my brow, trying to recall every last scrap of information. I could conjure a mental picture of the small, tattered brown copy of A Child's History of England, read by the flickering light of a kerosene lantern in a mud hut somewhere in Persia. Mentally flicking the pages, I could just recall the two-page section that was all the author had seen fit to devote to the Second Jacobite Rising, known to historians as the 45. And within that two-page section, the single paragraph dealing with the battle we were about to fight.
"The Scots win," I said helpfully.
"Well, that's the important point," he agreed, a bit sarcastically. "But it would be a bit of help to know a little more."
"If you wanted prophecy, you should have gotten a seer," I snapped, then relented. "I'm sorry. It's only that I don't know much, and it's very frustrating."
"Aye, it is."
He reached down and took my hand, squeezing it as he smiled at me.
"Dinna fash yourself, Sassenach. You canna say more than you know. But tell me it all, just once more."
"All right."
I squeezed back, and we walked on, hand in hand. "It was a remarkable victory," I began, reading from my mental page, "because the Jacobites were so greatly outnumbered. They surprised General Cope's army at dawn. They charged out of the rising sun. I remember that. And it was a rout. There were hundreds of casualties on the English side, and only a few from the Jacobite side. 30 men, that was it. Only 30 men killed."
Jamie glanced behind us at the straggling tail of the Lallybroch men, strung out as they walked along the road,
chatting and singing in small groups. 30 men was what we had brought from Lallybroch. It didn't seem that small a number, looking at them. But I had seen the battlefields of Alsace-Lorraine, and the acres of meadowland converted to muddy boneyards by the burial of the thousands slain. "Taken all in all," I said, feeling faintly apologetic, "I'm afraid it was really rather unimportant, historically speaking." Jamie blew out his breath through pursed lips and looked down at me rather bleakly.
"Unimportant?
Aye, weel. I'm sorry," I said.
"Not your fault, Sassenach."
But I couldn't help feeling that it was, somehow. The men sat around the fire after their supper, lazily enjoying the feeling of full stomachs, exchanging stories, and scratching. The scratching was endemic. Close quarters and lack of hygiene made body lice so common as to excite no remark when one man detached a representative specimen from a fold of his plaid and tossed it into the fire. The louse flamed for an instant, one among the sparks of the fire, and then was gone. The young man they called Kincaid, his name was Alexander, but there were so many Alexanders that most of them ended up being called by nicknames or middle names, seemed particularly afflicted with the scourge this evening. He dug viciously under one arm, into his curly brown hair, then, with a quick glance to see whether I was looking in his direction, at his crotch.
"Got 'em bad, have you, lad?" Ross the smith observed sympathetically.
"Aye," he answered, "the wee buggers are eating me alive."
"Bloody hell to get out of your cock hairs, man,"
Wallace Fraser observed, scratching himself in sympathy.
"Gives me the uke to watch you, laddie."
"Do you ken the best way to rid yourself of the wee beasties?"
Sawley McClure asked helpfully, and at Kincaid's negative shake of the head, leaned forward and carefully pulled a flaming stick from the fire.
"Lift your kilt a moment, laddie, and I'll smoke 'em out for you,"
he offered, to catcalls and jeers of laughter from the men.
"Bloody farmer," Murtaugh grumbled, "and what would you know about it?"
"You know a better way?"
Wallace raised thick brows sceptically, wrinkling the tan skin of his balding forehead.
"Of course."
He drew his dirk with a flourish.
"The laddie's a soldier now. Let him do it like a soldier does."
Kincaid's open face was guileless and eager.
"How's that?" "Weel, very simple. You take your dirk, lift your plaidie, and shave off half the hairs on your crutch."
He raised the dirk warningly.
"Only half, mind."
"Half? Aye, well."
Kincaid looked doubtful, but was paying close attention. I could see the grins of anticipation broadening on the faces of the men around the fire, but no one was laughing yet.
"Then,"
Murtaugh gestured at Sawley and his stick,
"then, laddie, you set the other half on fire, and when the beasties rush out, you spear them with your dirk."
Kincaid blushed hotly enough to be seen even by firelight, as the circle of men erupted in hoots and roars. There was a good deal of rude shoving as a couple of the men pretended to try the fire cure on each other, brandishing flaming billets of wood. Just as it seemed that the horseplay was getting out of hand and likely to lead to blows in earnest, Jamie returned from hobbling the animals. He stepped into the circle and tossed a stone bottle from under one arm to Kincaid. Another went to Murtaugh, and the shoving died down.
"You're fools, the lot of you," he declared. "The second best way to rid yourself of lice is to pour whiskey on them and get them drunk. When they've fallen down snoring, then you stand up, and they'll drop straight off." "Second best, eh?" said Ross. "And what's the best way, sir, and I might ask?"
Jamie smiled indulgently round the circle, like a parent amused by the antics of his children.
"Why, let your wife pick 'em off ye, one by one."
He cocked an elbow and bowed to me, one eyebrow raised.
"If you'd oblige me, my lady."
While put forward as a joke, individual removal was, in fact, the only effective method of ridding oneself of lice. I fine-combed my own hair, all of it, morning and evening, washed it with yarrow whenever we paused near water deep enough to bathe in, and had so far avoided any serious infestations. Aware that I would remain louseless only so long as Jamie did, I administered the same treatment to him whenever I could get him to sit still long enough.
"Baboons do this all the time," I remarked,
delicately disentangling a foxtail from his thick red mane.
"But I believe they eat the fruits of their labours."
"Dinna let me prevent you, Sassenach, and you feel so inclined," he responded.
He hunched his shoulders slightly, in pleasure, as the comb slid through the thick, glossy strands. The firelight filled my hands with a cascade of sparks and golden streaks of fire.
You wouldn't think it felt so nice to have someone comb your hair for you."
"Wait till I get to the rest of it," I said, tweaking him familiarly and making him giggle.
"Tempted, though I am, to try Myrtle's suggestion instead."
"Touch my cock hairs with your torch and you'll get the same treatment," he threatened.
"What was it Louise de la Tour says bald lassies are? Erotic."
I leaned forward and nipped the upper flange of one ear between my teeth.
"Well, tastes differ," I said. "Chacun a son goût, and all that."
"A bloody French sentiment, and I ever heard one."
"Isn't it, though?"
A loud rolling growl interrupted my labours. I laid down the comb and peered ostentatiously into the tree-filled shadows.
"Either," I said, "there are bears in this wood, or..."
"Why haven't you eaten?"
"I was busy with the beasts," he answered. "One of the ponies has a cracked hoof, and I had to bind it with a poultice. Not that I've so much appetite, what with all this talk of eating lice."
"What sort of poultice do you use on a horse's hoof?" I asked, ignoring this remark.
"Different things. Fresh dung will do in a pinch. I used chewed vetch leaves mixed with honey this time."
The saddlebags had been dumped by our private fire near the edge of the small clearing where the men had erected my tent. While I would have been willing to sleep under the stars, as they did, I admitted to a certain thankfulness for the small privacy afforded me by the sheet of canvas. And, as Murtor had pointed out with his customary bluntness when I thanked him for his assistance in erecting the shelter, the arrangement wasn't solely for my benefit.
"And if he takes his ease between your thighs of a night, there's none will grudge it to him,"
the little clansman had said, with a jerk of the head toward Jamie, deep in conversation with several of the other men.
"But there's nae need to make the lads think o'er much of the things they canna have now, is there?"
"Quite," I said, with an edge to my voice. "Very thoughtful of you." One of his rare smiles curled the corner of the thin-lipped mouth.
"Ugh! Quite," he said.
A quick rummage through the saddlebags turned up a heel of cheese and several apples. I gave these to Jamie, who examined them dubiously.
"No bread?" he asked.
"There may be some in the other bag. Eat those first, though. They're good for you." He shared the Highlander's innate suspicion of fresh fruit and vegetables, though his great appetite made him willing to eat almost anything in extremity. He said, taking a bite of one apple.
"If you say so, Sassenach."
"I do say so. Look." I pulled my lips back, baring my teeth. "How many women of my age do you know who still have all their teeth?" A grin bared his own excellent teeth.
"Well, I'll admit you're very well preserved, Sassenach, for such an old crone."
"Well nourished is what I am," I retorted. "Half the people on your estate are suffering from mild scurvy, and from what I've seen on the road, it's even worse elsewhere. It's vitamin C that prevents scurvy, and apples are full of it." He took the apple away from his mouth and frowned at it suspiciously.
"They are."
"Yes, they are," I said firmly. "So are most other kinds of plants. Oranges and lemons are best, but of course you can't get those here. But onions, cabbages, apples, eat something like that every day and you won't get scurvy. Even green herbs and meadow grass have vitamin C."
"And that's why deer dinna lose their teeth as they get old."
"I dare say." He turned the apple to and fro, examining it critically, then shrugged.
"Aye, well,"
he said, and took another bite.